The minutes of the hearing from Friday, March 9th, 2007. Oh. Is there any motion to adopt them?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
I move the amendment be adopted.
Senator Marty moves the amendments be adopted. Any corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. Members, as I had explained on Friday during the middle of the hearing, we learned that we had not received the proper report with regard to Senate File 317. So that bill is now properly in our possession. We did not ask Senator Bonhoff to come back, but we want, since we actually did believe we had taken action on it, what we would like to do is adopt the amendments that we had proposed at that time, and then pass the bill on. We have the amendments. Mr. Bricquetti, do you have the amendments?
Madam Chairwoman, I do. On line 1.13, there was movement to strike the word several. To strike the word several.
Okay.
And there was the A1 amendment.
Do we have the A1 amendment? We'll put this aside momentarily and come back to it. Senator Coring. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Scogin, second. Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. Welcome to the committee. We have Senate File 1250 before
correct.
Us.
Thank you, and thank you for sliding us up. We have another commitment over in the House, so I appreciate moving us up on the agenda.
Sure.
With me today is Bob Meyer with the DNR. What you're looking at in Senate File 1250 is the second stop for a part of this bill, the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill, today talking about some of the rules, and Bob Meyer is here to help me walk you through that.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The provisions that bring this bill before you today are found in sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They deal with the DNR's rulemaking processes and also establishes or extends the sunset provision for the Minerals Coordinating Committee. Section 1 of the bill, you'll see, deals with the Game and Fish expedited rules, and what we're trying to do here is allow for the expedited rules that we draft to not sunset after 18 months, but rather become permanent rules. These rules that we use the expedited process for deal with the mundane decisions that we go through dealing with zones, permit area boundaries, designating fish spawning beds, fish preserves, the processes we use to select hunters and anglers for areas, to register the registration of game and fish, prevent and control wildlife disease, or to correct errors or omissions. Many of the things that we do through expedited rule are part of our Game and Fish booklet that we publish every year dealing with the seasons. And what this does, it will allow those expedited rules to become permanent rather than expiring, as I mentioned. Section 2 deals with infested waters, and we want to exempt the processes that we have for designating infested waters from the rulemaking process. You'll see on page 2.13 that the designation of infested waters by the commissioner shall be by written order published in the state register. and these designations are not subject to the rulemaking provisions of Chapter 14 and 14.386 do not apply. This is similar to many other provisions that the DNR has related to decisions that need to be done in a quick manner, but that we do need to make sure there is proper notification of the public. There's also substantial notification and press release information that goes along with these designations. You'll see on going back to 2.3, we're just clarifying that we do have the ability to designate connected bodies of water that do have the ability to become infested. We have an issue in northern Minnesota right now dealing with some of the lakes in Voyageurs National Park and some other lakes that are infested with the spiny water flea. We need to make sure that we designate not just the infested body but parts of those chains of lakes, so to speak. That's what we're trying to clarify there. Section 3 of the bill deals with the previous section, taking out infested waters from required rules. And Section 4 is also technical related to the rulemaking provision in Section 2. Section 5 of the bill is expanding or continuing the sunset provision for the Minerals Management Coordinating Board. This is an advisory committee made up of union representatives, university officials, members of the Department of Natural Resources that help us plan for our minerals exploration activities throughout
the
state.
What's the name of that committee?
Minerals Coordinating Committee. They meet and they help provide the state with direction on our minerals exploration activities within
when was
the state.
When was it first brought into being? In
1987.
And at that time was the sunset, has it been like extended 3 or 4 times, a period of every 4 years or so, is that correct? When was the last extension of the expiration date given?
Madam Chair, I'd like to bring up Paul Poljar from our Lands and Minerals Division. I believe it was probably in 2003.
Okay. That's when a lot of the other commissions or advisory boards that we're going to be hearing later were sunsetted. And so this one was continued. Is that correct, sir? And if you'd identify yourself
Madam
for the record.
Madam Chairman, my name is Paul Poljar with the Department of Natural Resources, Lands and Minerals. And that is correct.
Okay.
It was extended in 2003 for 4 years.
And I appreciate that you are extending the sunset rather than repealing it. Thank you. Is that it for our committee?
Two other spots that was just brought to my attention.
Is this funny?
Section 6, establishing fees for the use of lands 3.3 to 3.7. Establishing fees by written order to the state register for the use of activities on wildlife management areas or aquatic management areas. We're exempting that from rulemaking. And then Section 13 of the bill.
And why is that the case?
It's just the establishment of what the actual fee would be. We feel that rather than
you don't need a rule, you don't need a rulemaking, okay?
The department has a lot of activities that are just a decision, a yes or no, what the price should be.
Got it.
You'll probably see some more of those come through this committee in the next couple years as well. Section 13, you can see on lines 5.23 and 5.24. This deals with establishing the price of processing applications for fishing tournaments. We want to just make sure that we publish that in the state register and that it does not apply to rulemaking as well. That is all the
thank you. Any questions for the witnesses or for Senator Scogin? Seeing none, Senator Vickerman moves that Senate file 1250 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. As many are in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you
Senator.
For your time.
Senator Coring. Senator Coring, Senate File 585.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. This is going to be a quick one for you. This is a repeal. Last year, some legislation was passed out of this place that should have never, ever happened. What the deal is in Little Falls, they have the Weyerhaeuser Muser Mansions, which were given to the city of Little Falls And the city of Little Falls is responsible for these mansions. This legislation really tied the hands of the city in telling them really what they could do with these. And so we want to repeal this language. The League of Minnesota Cities is here. They're supportive of this language. The history... Historical Society is here, and they got any, if you have any questions. And I would just turn it over to the city attorney for Little Falls, Tony Wetzel.
Senator Coring, I think we'll deal with this very briefly.
Okay.
Probably going to be supporting it, so if you can be very brief, that would be great.
Go ahead, Tony.
Thank you. As Mr. Senator Coring said, I'm Tony Wetzel, and we are requesting the repeal of Minnesota Statute Section 15.995. The unintended consequence of this statute is to completely handcuff the city's ability to manage its own properties. We believe this is properly vested in the local government and can only be properly addressed by and through the local government, and therefore we're asking for your assistance and for the repeal of this statute.
Is there any discussion or questions?
And Madam Chair, if I could just say one thing, I'd like to have this move on its own, if I may.
I understand that.
Okay.
Are there any questions for the witness or Senator Coring? Senator
Just
Betzel.
Just a brief question. Senator Coring, I'm trying to remember what happened last year that caused this to go.
Senator Coring.
Do you want to explain it?
If that would be okay, I think I can explain it. What happened was these two mansions were subject to a possible sale to a private developer, and the concern was that the private developer was going to raise these mansions and put up instead condominiums. And so the Representative Blaine took measures to try and stop the sale of this property to a private developer. But again, the end result of the bill was the unintended consequence of completely handcuffing the city from being able to engage in any of the general managements with respect to the property. And so we're asking that this bill be rescinded completely and allow the local government to deal with it appropriately and as it deems best for the citizens and for the mansions.
And then...
Mr. Chair, was it part of some omnibus
Senator
bill
Betzel.
Or something that passed?
And then, Madam Senator Chair Coring. And Senator Betzel, yes, this was put through the Senate through an omnibus bill that I had no idea that it was slid in there, and it was beyond my control. So,
Senator Day,
I was going to move the bill, but I think
Senator Pappas,
Madam Chair, had a.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Coring, so the property, it's two properties or one?
One.
One property, it's an old, some kind of historic mansion, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Senator Pappas, you have to go through chair.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, can
Senator
I
Pappas.
Talk now?
Yep.
Okay. But it's on the National Register of Historic Places, so there already is restrictions on what can be done with the property.
Absolutely.
Senator Coring.
Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, that is correct.
Senator
Madam
Pappas.
Chair. And so what does the city intend to do with it?
Senator Coring.
Well, I guess Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, I'm not exactly sure what the city intends on doing with it. The property was left to the city of Little Falls, and along with a $1 million endowment to try to take care of the property. And so I guess I leave it up to the city of Little Falls. I'm not exactly sure, but it's my understanding, and the city attorney can probably attest to this, but I think that the city council would like to preserve those properties and continue on. But the problem being is they're tremendously large houses that take a lot of maintenance, and you know, I would like to see the Historical Society take over these properties, but you know, the legislature has cut the Historical Society's budget by 17%, and I've talked to them about it, and they said, we can't even handle the properties that we have now. And so...
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, you keep saying these properties. I thought it was just... I'm confused now.
Well,
is there one house or two?
Madam
Senator
Chair
Coring.
And Senator Pappas, there are two houses, and what I'm referring to is we have the library. Is that correct?
The library and the Convention Bureau.
The library and the Convention Bureau that were affected by this legislation also. And the city attorney, I guess, can better explain that than me, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, if you want an explanation.
I do.
Yeah.
Ma'am?
Thank you. Yes, there are three properties that the City of Little Falls has on the National Register. The Linden Hills property is what they collectively call the two mansions, but it sits on one piece of property. So that's your source of confusion, is it's two great big mansions, but it sits on one piece of property that was owned by ultimately Laura Jane Muzzer, who then gifted that piece of property with the two mansions to the city. The other two pieces of property are Carnegie Library, and then the Convention Bureau sits in what I believe was referred to as the old Rosenmeyer House, which is also the city now leases that to the Convention Bureau. So those are our three pieces of property. And when this law was passed, it in effect said the city could no longer lease or contract with any other individuals with regards to those properties without waiting for 2 years, having appraisals and all sorts of other things. And in effect, then, legally, the city could no longer operate its library and rent that building to the library, nor could it rent to the Visitors Bureau.
Senator Pappas.
Just one more question. So, Madam Chair, so the intention, the city doesn't want to tear down these historic houses. The city just wants to be able to lease them or have some flexibility in terms of figuring out what the usage is going to be.
Senator Coring. Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, that is correct. And I would also, what we neglected to point out is the city actually did have a lawsuit against the state on this, saying you can comment on that. They had a lawsuit against the state, and they have since dropped that lawsuit in hopes that this legislation will be taken off the books. And I guess, Madam Chair, I'd like to just explain the lawsuit a little bit, if that'd be okay, or all right.
I got it.
Senator Day?
Madam Chair, I would like to move the bill. And
thank you.
We'll get
Senator Day moves that Senate File 585 be recommended to pass. If there are discussion, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering, there was a request to the Historical Society for a study for the best use of the property. Did that ever get underway? Did you ever receive a report like that? It never occurred.
Never. Madam Chair, Senator Roebling never did get a report going like that, as far as I know. No. No.
Any other questions? Anybody else want to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Day renews his motion that Senate File 585 be recommended to pass. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Coring.
Thank you.
Okay, we're on Senate File 1176. We are going to be getting copies of the engrossment on that, Senator Coring.
Where does this bill go?
And so we're going to wait on that. We're going to go back to Senator Bonoff's bill, Senate File 317. There was just that one amendment, and that amendment was to, on line 113, to strike the word several. Senator Lurie moves that. On line 1, moves to amend Senate File 317 to strike the word several on line 113. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 317 before us as amended. Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 317 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We are going to wait for the engrossment. Is it here? Okay, Senator Coring. We do have the engrossment now of 11, Senate File 1176. Senator Coring, would you like to explain your bill?
Madam Chair and committee members, this was brought to me by some local folks up in my district. If you're not aware, we have about a 5,000-acre area there that is in the process of being developed, and somehow several years ago there was a council exactly like this, and it was taken out of statute. And so what we're just trying to do is the folks in the area feel very strongly about having input into how this area, this 5,000 acres, is developed, and they would like to have this this advisory committee put back into statute. This passed unanimously out of Senator Chaudhry's committee, and I'm hoping that we can do the same thing here. And so I do have a testifier that would like to talk about this, Madam Chair.
Okay, and then Senator Coring will go through the guidelines for advisory councils and see whether your bill meets them. Sir.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, John Lilly, Assistant Director, State Parks. The department, the division, is supportive of the advisory council. As Senator Coring pointed out, it was in legislation in 92 when we first started the Cuyuna Rec area. They were very instrumental historically in establishing the management plan for the area and have been over time in helping to both plan and develop. So the advisory council is simply something that that was there. It's being put back in. Section 2 has to deal with permits and fees at both Croft Mine and Portsmouth Mine Overlook, and except for camping, those park fees and permits would be eliminated. And in Section 3 deals with three pieces, actually. It has to do with memorializing or commemorating the Manhai event. And what's included here is a interpretive kiosk and also some landscaping of that same area for better aesthetics. And as it's pointed out here, there will also need to be some highway signing on Highway 6, and that it's very near the highway right away. So those are the three pieces of the bill.
Senator Coring, your bill needs a number of amendments to meet the guidelines that this committee has established. And I'm going to tell you what it appears to be lacking.
Okay.
And then I'm going to lay your bill over so that you can get the amendments drafted so that this bill can go on to finance in a proper form. First of all, as far as I can see, you don't, when you, on line 119, you say an elected state official, but you don't say who would appoint that elected state official. We need to know. You have the name of the group. You have the total number of members. You don't say who will appoint these folks. And that works okay when you say it's a representative from, like, the Cuyuna Range Mine Land Recreation Area Joint Powers Board, because we assume that they will appoint them a member of their own. But an elected state official doesn't meet that.
Okay.
I don't know who would be appointing that person. And secondly, there's no convening authority. We need to know who would be able to call this group into being at its first meeting. You do meet the goal of the chair of the group. You make reference to compensation, that is, that there would be none. You do it's not clear to me what the duties of this group are. I don't see anything for them to do in the advisory council. What are their obligations? That's the duty? Well, he can respond. He can tell me that.
What's an elected state official?
We ask for some accountability, and I don't see where this group, who this group is held accountable to. And I'm not trying to be difficult here, but these guidelines were published February 19th, and I don't see any sunset language. And we would want a length of time that this group would be in in existence. So, Senator Coring, you're not the first person that's come with a bill that has these things that haven't been addressed, but the bill can't leave the committee without them being addressed. And I think it could you could deal with it very quickly, make those decisions very quickly. We can provide you with a copy of the guidelines, and we'll take the bill up again before the end of this hearing.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
I don't know if you caught page 1, line 19, it refers to this board having an elected state official.
I mentioned to him that there's, although these others have representatives from a particular group where we can assume that the group will be in charge of appointing that person, that particular line, there's no way to have that person because he doesn't reference who would be appointing that person, or he doesn't name that person. If you name that person by saying, you know, the commissioner of DNR or his or her designee or a deputy commissioner, if you name it by virtue of their office or appointment, that's one thing. But saying an elected state official doesn't get that person on this council.
Okay. And then, Madam Chair, if I could just ask, so an elected state official appointed by the legislature or
governor.
The governor?
If you want, I mean, whoever you'd like that person to be appointed by.
Me?
The senator.
All right,
from
we'll just try to get these amendments lined up and then come back.
You can do it all in one amendment.
All right.
And if you get that done before the end of the hearing.
All right.
So we're going to lay aside 1176. Senator Bach, yours is a very short bill, and you're here. We'll take yours, and then we'll go to Senator Lurie's bill. Senator Bach's bill is Senate File 1131.
Madam Chair, there is a first engrossment.
We have the first engrossment in front of the committee. Senator Bach, would you explain your bill?
Madam Chair, the issue is, in the case of commercial fishing on Lake Superior, we allow the commercial harvest of lake trout as a species. And but we don't actually have a commercial fishing season for lake trout, even though we allow for it in law. What we do provide for in DNR rules is the taking of lake trout by something called assessment netting, where commercial fishermen actually take a set number of trout every year, and they weigh them, take some scales off of them, measure them, and then the DNR gets the information so they can monitor the condition of the lake trout fishery in Lake Superior. What this bill does is increases, because that's in rule, not in statute, what this does is puts in statute an increase in the number of fish that can be taken under this assessment program, and allows the DNR, by a good cause exemption to the rulemaking authority, to get this provision into law for this year's season. If they were to have to go through the regular rulemaking process to change this, that's very cumbersome and couldn't be done in time for this season. So this just allows the good cause exemption.
Is there any testimony you want to offer on this bill? Is there anybody who wants to speak about Senate File 1131, either in support or opposition?
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, this had extensive hearings in Senator Chaudhry's committee, and we worked out all the problems, and I'll vouch for that. So
and the policy
like
part of it, we're just talking about whether this is good enough for an exemption to the rulemaking, and Senator Vickerman thinks it is. So Senator Vickerman moves that Senate File 1131, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm still looking this over because dropping from 50 to 25 residents is pretty significant, and I'm trying to understand how you're going to get that number down if the people who have had a value of at least $1,500 in previous fish netting, or is it netting? I mean, I'm trying to figure how you're going to reach that goal of 25 residents after you've had 50 in the past.
Madam Chair, maybe the department can speak to that, but Senator Roebling, let me just say the 50 number is old, And there currently are, I believe, only 24 people doing this commercial fishing now in Lake Superior. So the 25 number, and if anything, as people die, they're not replaced by new commercial fishermen. And the reason the number has been getting smaller is people have been passing away. This is a number that the North Shore commercial fishermen have agreed to. In fact, it was their suggestion that, that gets the number more into line with the number of people that are currently doing it today.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Senator Bickerman renews his motion that Senate File 1131 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion fails. Thank you, Senator Box. Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, is the bill on general on its way to general orders?
Yes. Senator Lurie. Senator Lurie has Senate File 1048. Senator Lurie, did you have amendments?
Yes, we have one author's amendment that we would like to offer. It is, I think Senate Counsel is ready to read it. It should be a fairly simple amendment.
Okay. Mr. Bodern, would you direct our attention to?
Madam Chair, we'll start on page 2 of the bill. And on page 2, line 2, you would delete of the staff of and insert designated by, so that that sentence would read a member designated by the elected tribal presidents or chairpersons of the governing bodies of the list of bands and communities there. And then also on page 2, you delete lines 14 and 15. And then on page 3, line 4, this is mostly for clarification. On page 3, line 4, delete each, insert only, and then delete member and insert members on that same line. So the sentence will read, only formally designated tribal members of the council shall vote. That clarifies that, going back to page 2, that lengthy list of commissioners or their designees that you see on page 2, those are all non-voting members of the council.
Okay, we have the amendment as read to us by Mr. Bodern. On page 2, line 2, strike of the staff of, insert designated, delete lines 214 and 215. And on page 3, line 4, strike each, insert only, and strike member and insert members. This is an author's amendment. All those in favor, Senator Lurie moves adoption of the amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie, would you please explain your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is a restructuring of the Indian Affairs Council, essentially to better facilitate relations between the state government and various tribal governments within the state. It does really two things. It restructures the membership itself, and that's what a lot of the author's amendment was just dealing with. And it restates and cleans up some of the duties that the council will be called to perform, most important of which it calls for an annual summit between the elected tribal leaders, the legislative leadership, and the governor. The Indian Affairs Council has I'll step into the restructuring of the membership. Essentially, the way it used to be formed, it called for the tribal chairpersons or presidents themselves to be the members. And one of the big pieces is that now they can designate a member to come to the quarterly meetings and really get to the work of hammering out how to better facilitate the relations, and then call for an annual summit to act on the recommendations that come out of the working group. And then there would still be 13 state level from commissioners and one governor's appointed, and one member of the House of Representatives and one member of the Senate. And then again, it restates the duties, most notably adds the annual summit. And I know that we have a long list of bills to handle this afternoon, so I will ask for some testimony, but we will try to be brief in recognition of...
Senator Lori, I just want to understand Senator Council, with the language at 229 it's referring back to each of these commissioners may designate a staff member to serve instead. Is that
That's that each of the 13 commission or 12 commission level members could also designate a staff, the same as a tribal president or chairperson could designate a staff. So that does it's supposed to refer back to
Mr.
each.
Bodden,
does
it? It looks just a little strange to me to put that qualifying phrase just at the end as opposed to putting it
separate sentence
at the beginning.
Yeah.
Or just
if I can give it some thought for a moment, I'll come up with an amendment for you.
Okay, I think just to make it read better, we understand what you're you're trying to do there.
I will.
Okay, your testimony then.
Okay, Chairman George Googly from Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is George Googly Jr., and I'm the chairman for the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe. I'm also a current member of the Indian Affairs Council as it is written now, or as it exists now. I'm a member of the executive committee, as I am the secretary of that council. We have been, for about the last year, we've been working on this issue, realizing that the document created back in 1963 does not really fit the direction that the tribes feel we should be going. So we did some planning. We did some meeting on the executive levels with all the members of the tribes being represented. And we submitted this information as a new direction for us. We feel it's important to do this because of the let me just back up real quick. The communication that has been established has been great. Let me say that. But it's important to for us to move in this direction because it reflects the current structures that that currently exist with the Indian Affairs Council. I think unanimously we all agree that it shouldn't be our tribal leadership that participates on this level, that we should have designated people within our tribes, very much modeling what the state has. We've got just about every function of a government that the state has, we also have as well. So we feel it's important for them to be active participants on this level.
Okay, anyone else?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Jolynn Shaptis, Communications and Legislative Director for Indian Affairs Council, and I'll hold my testimony if there are any questions.
Okay. Senator Lori, Mr. Small?
Yes. Mr. Small will just be here to
stand
for questions.
Senator Pappas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that you're going from ex officio or non-voting members. I assume that sometimes...
No, it just ex officio just means by virtue of the position they hold, they're a member. And then from there, you can designate somebody as voting or non-voting.
Okay, so then my question
Mr.
is...
Mr. Bodden explained that to us
to clarify, there are no ex officio members any longer, the way I read this.
There are ex officio members.
Well, they are not named as ex officio members.
However, if you say a member of the Grand Portage Band, that the Grand Portage Band has, by virtue of it being named in the legislation, a member of this group. So it's not saying, and among all the tribes, pick 10.
Right.
That's the difference.
Okay.
So they're in here because they are representatives from specific groups. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, then I'm sorry. I always thought ex officio meant non-voting. And
too, but
so were these commissioners, are there representatives in the past Were they voting members, or
no,
were they
non-voting? No,
they were not.
The 11 tribal members were the only voting members historically, and that is how it remains today. The 11 tribal members are the only voting members.
Okay. Then, Madam Chair?
After the author's amendment that we...
Oh, author's amendment. I didn't see that. That's the problem.
Said the author's amendment now reads only tribal on page 2, line 2. No, I'm sorry. Page 3, line 4. Only formally designated tribal members of the council shall vote.
Thank you. I'm sorry I missed the author's amendment.
That's fine.
Any other questions? Senator Roebling.
I'm still kind of trying to figure out how this council is set up. So the state provides money for staff for the council, but we don't have any state officials who can vote on the council.
Right.
Senator Lurie.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, that is the way it has always operated, yes.
You're not proposing any changes?
We're not proposing any changes to that.
Any other questions? Is there any other person who would like to testify in favor or against this? And your particular council doesn't, we don't need to worry about who's going to convene the group, because all you're doing is changing something that's in existence. And I think everything else is already... You have provisions for a chair and duties and so forth. Do you have a sunset provision in this?
There is no sunset provision. Is that
and
correct?
I think they are specifically excluded, are they not, Mr. Bodern?
Madam Chair and members, Section 15059 does exclude multi-member agencies that would have grant-making or rulemaking authority or are required by federal law, and I'm not certain. I think this may serve some purpose under federal law as well, but those are general exemptions, and historically the council has not been subject to the expiration date.
Okay. Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
I'm looking at page 4, lines 29 through 32, and I just want to make sure I understand that the council is indeed only recommending to tribal governments and the state government the means to enhance the delivery of services to members of tribal sovereign nations in Minnesota by local, state, and national units of government. Because all of a sudden, I mean, before they were only a liaison between the local units of government and the state and national units, and now they're making recommendations, and there's nothing in here, and I'm only reading this line, this little section at this time, that says that those recommendations, they are just recommendations, right?
Yes.
There's nothing that can force local units of government.
There's no binding language.
They're non-binding.
No.
Okay, thank you.
Any other discussion? Anybody else want to testify in favor or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Lurie moves that Senate file 1040.
We did have one more amendment we were working on to clean up your...
Oh, Mr. Bodern, you have the amendment now?
Sure. Madam Chair and members... we just wanted to clean up the language allowing commissioners to designate staff members. So on page 2, line 29, delete each of whom may designate a staff member to. And on page 2, line 30, delete serve instead. Save the semicolon. And actually, going back to line 29, we need to pick up the comma, but we can deal with that later. And then on page 2, after line 32, insert a new sentence that will read, each of the commissioners listed in this subdivision may designate a staff member to serve on the council instead of the commissioner.
Okay. Is that clear?
Well, would that go after line 32, which is the Senate and House?
We're after line 30.
Memberships, or would it go after
line Senator Lurie, it's this whole list, and then it just goes back and makes a statement about part of the list.
Except that I don't think that the member from the House of Representatives and the member from the Senate would be able to designate. That's not the intent.
He said that the amendment would read, each of the commissioners listed in this section will have a designee if they so choose.
There's my amendment.
All right. All those in favor of Senator Lurie's amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Lurie then moves that Senate file 1048 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to and recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you very much. The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Motion prevails. Okay. Senator Koch? We have now Senate File 837 before us, dealing with Hennepin and Wright counties. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I have Senate File 837 for your consideration, and I would like to thank the Chair for hearing this bill.
Sure.
While it is a small bill, it has some perhaps far-reaching implications, so I would just ask, as you hear the testimony, I have with me the Mayor of Rockford and Cynthia Gary, a citizen of Rockford, that you keep an open mind on this one. What we're asking for is a change in the county boundary line. The city of Rockford right now sits on two counties, and to be specific, we have 91 parcels, 200 residents of the city of Rockford in the county of Hennepin, and then it actually makes up about 12% of the total value, property value of the city, whereas the rest, the 88%, and the rest of the residents live on the Wright County side. And and I'll let the mayor talk about it, but there has been a petition that has been signed by the residents of Hennepin County, and they cite issues of police service, ambulance service, 911, and other county services as their reason for wanting to do this. So I will I'll let the mayor speak to you about the genesis of this and where they'd like to go with it.
Thank you, Amy Cole.
Mr. Beyer, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record. We'll hear your testimony.
Okay, thank you. My name is Michael Beyer, resident of Rockford, Minnesota, on the Wright County side. I'm also the present mayor of Rockford. I want to thank the committee for taking the time to look at this moving of the boundaries of Rockford. I realize that moving the county might seem like it may not make much of a difference, but I'm here to let you know that being in two counties is more than an inconvenience. I wish to clarify, though, the news report that said when the county ban came out for smoking, this is not the reason. I've been working on this since 2000 when I was elected as mayor. As a member of the Rockford Fire Department for 13 years and on the city council for the last 10 years, I've experienced firsthand some of these inconveniences of the county line. There was a petition presented to the city council for reasons for detaching from Hennepin County. The population on the Wright County side is around 3,600, and as Amy said, we've only got a few hundred on the Hennepin County side. I want to just highlight some of the things that were on the petition. Petition was presented to the council. One item number one was police protection. Taxes are collected by the city to pay for Wright County coverage, and many of the taxpayer and the county taxes on the Hennepin County side pay for Hennepin County services. The Wright County side, we do have 12 hours of service. On the Hennepin County side, we do not contract for any services. The Wright County does have jurisdiction 1,500 feet over the Crow River, which does not cover much of Wright County. So if a deputy needs to make an arrest or something, he can go 1,500 feet over the border. If not, he can be asked to aid by Hennepin County to go further into the border, but only to detain until Hennepin County shows up. If that happens, then the Wright County officer may be asked to testify, which he has to be taken out of the county and brought to Minneapolis to testify on something that would be further than 1,500 feet into Hennepin County. Ambulance services, I also have two ambulance services, North Memorial and Alina, which is not denoted by the county line that's written at the state level, happens to be the Crow River. But with the 911 dispatching service, if there's a critical situation over the river, it gets routed through Golden Valley to the ambulance service. Then they deem if they're out of position, they'll call Alina. Alina sits in Hanover, 5 miles away. North Memorial could be in Maple Grove, which then has been my experiences anywhere to up to 30 minutes to get that response. With previous Senator Olson that was in my district, we did sit down with the services. It has improved dramatically in that they do position an ambulance in Corcoran when the times are slow. But as far as Alina, they still keep one in Hanover or in Buffalo, which is
quite a few miles less. Which brings me to the primary thing that this has brought, came about, was the 911 service. If you live on the Hennepin County side, you're routed to Golden Valley for a Hennepin County assistance. If they deem it necessary, they will then call Buffalo, which will then start out anything that can be helped on that side. Being on the fire and rescue has been one of the more important things, and I have situations, if there are questions, that I can cite on that. But unfortunately, with that routing is precious time. And I do have the statement from one gentleman who had chest pains in Hennepin County side, and his terms were he argued with the dispatch to convince them to start the ambulance. He's the one that presented the petition, by the way. He may be here today. I don't know. Otherwise, I have his statement. But that's the biggest situation is the telephone conversations between Golden Valley and Buffalo to decide if Rockford Fire and Rescue, which we are very capable of life-threatening situations, need to be called out. And I have documentation as far as times we were never called out. Representation. During the election time, Rockford has to have two booths, one for Hennepin County, one for Wright County. We have to have a dual judges, one for Hennepin County, one for Wright County. But the decisions that are made for by the county commissioners, being a majority of Wright County, we follow that, but then we have the other lead of Hennepin County, and in such a small sliver, not much affects that part of the world. County services, I've already talked to everybody on the Wright County side as far as any kind of human services that need to be if the county line were to change. They had no situations or issues with that. Such things as civic duty. I had a gentleman who had jury duty, got to drive all the way to Minneapolis and stand 2 weeks on trial. I had jury duty. I got to go to Buffalo. Again, 30 miles versus 10 miles. As a mayor, we do have to budget two county assessors. We have two attorneys. We have the two sheriff's departments, as you know. And the big thing on the county assessors is property is valued based on Hennepin County value. And I do have documentation also in regards to if it was a Wright County assessed property versus a Hennepin County assessed property. And I want to make it very clear that this whole thing never started with property values. It has been strictly a public service issue. Unfortunately, heart attacks and car accidents I've personally been to. And it has turned out that the taxation in Hennepin County is much higher than it would if these same homes were in Wright County. The people that signed the petition were never told that because I never went even after that information. It has been requested, so we did pull this information together if you're interested in that part of it.
Are there any questions for this witness? And then we'll hear from the other one. Then I have a couple for the senator. Yeah. Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I want to be sure that the citizens of this area are aware of what you're doing, because I used to chair this committee, and I know we went through a boundary. We used to have a boundary committee. Things change, and I'm going to support your bill, but I want to be sure that the public has a chance to weigh in on it.
How aware are the residents of Rockford of this particular legislation?
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Vickerman, we appreciate the question. That's a good one, because although there are only 200, they matter. And the actual petition came from a resident of this side, and the county there is a Wright County resolution supporting it. There were 85 signatures from the residents of Hennepin County on this issue. So they have been well informed of the situation, and I can let the mayor explain a little more what happened at the door when this information was conveyed.
And the message sent to Senator Koch, Madam Chair, was actually we were up to 135, because I got another page of petitions after it got sent to the council. The petitioners that went out and knocked door to door, because I live on the other side, I did not participate in that. Some of the comments were they couldn't take it out of the paper, out of their hands fast enough, and was it going to happen this year? Refusal to sign it did not exist. And like I say, out of the residents, I think the last count was 135. And then I did go and speak in front of the House of Representatives with Senator Ember at that time. And now I'm getting, like, the reason Cynthia's here, she read my newsletter that says I'm bringing it again. I want to get this thing fixed. And she called, and that's why she's here today.
Maybe we'll hear from the other witness briefly now. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Cynthia Gary, and I am a resident of Rockford on the Hennepin County side. I am a young mother with two children. I have a 15-year-old son and we all know how 15-year-olds are. And the trouble I'm having living in two counties is the buck falls when you have a child in crisis. He was doing wrong things. I did report it to the sheriffs. Wright County did not want to help in any way with what he had done. And so Hennepin County could go no further. So I was left with a child who was stealing stuff, and he can bounce between two counties, and Wright won't touch him because I live in Hennepin. Mm-hmm. And as a mother, when you ground him, that's not enough when he's going down a wrong road. He is on probation. All the services for a child in crisis are downtown. I can't get him downtown because of how far away I live. It can take over an hour without traffic to get downtown. Probation closes at 4, so then I have to have a day of work done by 2 to even get him down there. He is on random UAs. Nobody from downtown will come out and give him a UA because we'd live too far away. And it makes it very hard when Wright County's right there. They can't help me because I don't live there. And Hennepin County doesn't want to help me because I'm too far away. And
Madam Chair.
That's very compelling testimony.
It's very hard. I ground him. I've taken his door. I've done stuff like that. But when we go to court in Wright County will sit there all day. We'll get in front of the judge. The guy at the other side of the table will say, ma'am, where do you live? The second I say Hennepin County, we're kicked out of court. Mm-hmm. And then I have to wait 6 to 8 weeks to get to Hennepin County. I get down in Hennepin County. The lady asks, where did this crime happen? I have to say it happened in Wright County. Nothing happens to him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to save my son when I'm looking for resources. I can't do it by myself, and nobody will help me because of where I live.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
In the spirit of good government, you've convinced me to vote for this bill, so I'd like to move it.
I'd like to thank you very much.
I'll call on you to move it, Senator Vickerman. I do want to ask, the legislation says that the boards may by resolution in lieu of the petition, according to statutes, and they cite the section. Is that just a majority? It's required on there, or in something like this, is a supermajority required?
Madam Chair, committee members, just to be sure everyone's clear, this bill doesn't take a position on whether or not the change of boundaries is a good idea. What it does is allows the process.
I know. I'm asking what for the resolution by the county board. Does the statute that's cited require a majority or a supermajority?
Madam Chair of the county board.
Yes.
A majority.
Just a plain majority. Okay. Are there other questions for Senator Koch or the witnesses, Senator Pappas and then Senator Betzel?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. McGowan said that he didn't think that this provided for an outcome, but I'm questioning the language on 111 and 112 to provide for the inclusion of the entire corporate limits of the City of Rockford and Wright County. It does seem like it's looking for an outcome, and if Hennepin County is going to be okay with that, I mean, what's Hennepin County's position on this?
Senator Koch.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Pappas. Wright County has drafted a resolution. Hennepin County, I believe it received a hearing at the Hennepin County at the middle of last year, and they took no action on it at that time.
This is just permissive. It's just permissive. They may do it. They don't have to do it. Senator Betzel.
It's a question for Senate Council, Madam Chair. Section 2 is effective without local approval in accordance with Statute 645.023. What does that provide?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, there is an exception from local approval for local units of government or contiguous local units of government that have a population in excess of 1 million. So Hennepin and Wright together have a population in excess of 1 million. So this would not require local approval of either county to make the law effective.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. I'm confused because the explanation says that it does require the approval of voters in each of the two counties. So is the brief
perhaps you're looking at
Madam
it
Chair.
Wrong?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
McGowan.
Madam Chair, Senator Pappas, there's two issues here. There is the making the law effective, the local approval clause, that is not required, but it is required. In fact, it's a constitutional requirement that a change of county boundaries be approved by the voters in both counties. Okay. So Senator Vickerman wondered if the voters would be aware of this. They will be aware of it because it'll be on the general election ballot.
But to get it there, you don't need the petition.
You don't need the 123,000 petitions.
You don't need 123,000 people in Kennepin County making the minimum number of people to get it on the general election ballot. Right. Only a resolution by the county boards will get it there. I mean, you only need that. Is that now clear to folks? Okay, Senator Vickerman.
And then, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel. To be clear, the earliest this could happen would be a general election would be November 08.
That's correct.
Okay.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I move that.
Moves that Senate File 837 be recommended to pass. Is there further discussion? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the bill is passed.
Thank you very much.
Senator Koch. Senator Michelle is here. Senator Michelle brings us Senate File 1236. Senator Michelle.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 1236 is Department of Employee Relations housekeeping bill. Madam Chair, with three specific sections. I do have the A07. I'm hoping the committee has that as an author's amendment to start, Madam Chair.
I don't have this bill.
The Senate counsel for this bill is Mr. Botter, and he's not in the room. We're looking for it. It's Senate File 1236, Mr. McGowan.
And Mr. McGowan, it's the A07 dealing with Section 3, voluntary unpaid leave of absence.
Madam Chair, I don't see it.
Madam Chair, perhaps while we're looking and scrambling, I can ask the Department of Employee Relations to just walk through this bill. It's fairly simple and straightforward with three sections. At some point, I would like to use that amendment.
Mr. Bottom will be back in just a moment, so why don't you go ahead and explain the rest of the bill, and then we'll deal with the your A7 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have with me this afternoon Lorna Smith from the department.
Ms. Smith.
Good afternoon, Chair, members. My name is Lorna Smith. I'm with the Department of Employee Relations. Section 1 is a technical clarification, or more accurately, it corrects a drafting error that we had made. This drafting error was made when we wrote the legislation to put into statute the current system for hiring new employees, which was a result of an 8-year pilot project. In drafting that, we had to revise numerous sections of 43A, which all work to ensure that DOER follows the merit system.
So Section 1 is a technical correction.
That is correct.
And what about the others? About Section 2?
Madam Chair, my name is Nathan Morocco, and I work for the Department of Employee Relations. Section 2 really deals with the State Employee Group Health Insurance Plan, better known as CGIP. The AG and the Department of Administration recommended that DOER clarify the provisions in CGIP that we may seek proposals and not bids when entering into new vendor contracts. The difference is that bids require contracting with the lowest costing vendor and are not subject to a negotiation, while proposals allow the contract to be negotiated, resulting in the selection of the most qualified vendor. And that really is the key piece for us. Contracting with health providers is both a cost and quality conditions for us that we would like to measure our potential vendors against. This is important because the RFP is dealing with servicing the health plans for the state employees. Expectations are intentionally set high in these RFPs and occasionally prove to be beyond the ability of the marketplace to deliver. In these situations, negotiations are critical in order to determine which vendor is able to deliver the best value. Often a costly but more qualified vendor can produce efficiencies that will provide a lower cost and more savings than the lowest costing vendor. This clarification became necessary when, during the 2005 legislative session, a provision was passed that allowed CGIP to contract with a wider variety of vendors than it previously was allowed. When that change was made, some of the language that clarified CGIP's ability to seek proposals was removed, leaving the matter uncertain. Passage of this provision will ensure that CGIP continues its past and current practices of contracting with the most qualified vendors. It also ensures that our state employee insurance plan will continue to provide high-quality products at reasonable prices. It does not create a change of practice. Madam Chair, I'd be happy
Senator,
to answer any questions.
Michelle, do you have a copy? We don't have any amendment for you.
I do, Madam Chair, and Mr. Bodden now has one.
Senator Michelle, turns out I have a copy of it too, but it's a lot of language, so we're going to make some copies of it. Maybe if you can explain the reason for it, and then when members get the language, they'll be able to ask questions looking at the language. So
Thank
we just
you.
Need a just a moment to make copies right outside the room.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for the paperwork. Members, this the amendment, which I hope you'll see someday, deals with what we want to do is continue the policy of voluntary unpaid leaves of absence. We want to continue that. Current language provides that these voluntary unpaid leaves of absence expired in June of 2005. So this bill would continue that practice through the 08-09 biennium. You'll recall that voluntary unpaid leaves have been used, or at least were able to be used by state agencies to save operating dollars while not eliminating staff, particularly back in 2003. So, Madam Chair, if I may, let me have Ms. Smith get into a little more of the policy while we await the language.
Okay, and Ms. Smith, if you would not just describe what it is you're trying to change it to, but how it's different from what current law is, I think that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, members, the amendment and the bill with the amendment on will make two changes. First of all, the voluntary unpaid leave of absence provision currently in Chapter 43 expired in 05. The amendment moves that language out of statute and puts it in session law. This provision has typically been in session law and currently is in session law. The second thing that
It extends it from the current from your current bill, which had it expiring in 2008, which was your original proposal, and you have asked for it to go to June 30th of 2009, correct?
Madam Chair, correct. That would be the second change.
I see.
The third change that the amendment will do to the bill is it deletes the repeal of Section 4 that is on page 3.
And why would we want to do that?
Section 4, what we were repealing was an early retirement benefit that was designed for certain employees of the BCA. All those employees have now retired. There are no more eligible for that. So in our minds, that is obsolete language. However, we found that some current retirees became nervous, thinking that would delete their current benefit, which we believe it doesn't. But for everyone's peace of mind, we're leaving it in.
I see. We have the amendment is now being distributed. So even though there's a lot of language here, a lot of it is current law. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
In fact, most of it.
Madam Chair, the only parts that are not current law are the change of the dates to make the provision extend into the next biennium, And secondly, vaguely not current law, we're taking this provision out of 43A and putting it into session law, which is confusing. However, current session
That's
law
why you
does
have to
have
all the language. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Do members have the amendment now? And this is an author's amendment. Senator Lori moves adoption of the AO7-0230 amendment. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We need to adopt it first.
Oh, okay.
It's an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to understand that if an employee takes an unpaid leave of absence and it says it's voluntary, they are responsible then for their contributions to their own retirement plan and for paid holidays and vacation and sick, or is the state covering that while they're on this voluntary unpaid leave?
Ms. Smith?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, all those benefits continue as if the employee were working. So whatever they were earning as a full-time employee, they would be earning while they were on the voluntary paid leave of unpaid leave of absence.
Madam Chair?
Senator Roebling?
So who gets to be the lucky employees who have these benefits? I mean, this is quite significant, really. They're getting health benefits, retirement benefits, vacation benefits. They're not getting paid, but they have taken voluntary unpaid leave.
Ms. Smith, why don't you tell us the kind of activities that are people that are doing that take a voluntary unpaid leave? What are they doing?
Madam Chair, it really could be any state employee whose agency approves of it and who has requested it. What the agency is saving is the salary dollars. Whatever part of the benefits the employee paid when they were working, they would continue to pay. Whatever portion the employer paid when that employee was working full-time, that employer continues to pay.
And so the unpaid leave could be up to 140 hours. How many weeks is that?
Half a year.
Madam Chair, I believe that is about roughly a half a year.
So, Madam Chair.
And that's over a two-year period. So it's like 26 weeks over a two-year period could possibly be taken for unpaid leave where they get no salary, but they continue their benefits, and that is current law. And you're just moving it to session law with those two exceptions.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this something that employees request or that the employer initiates?
Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it is usually by the employee request. Oftentimes, though, if the employer is having budgetary issues, they will request volunteers, and then employees may volunteer if they so choose.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
How many of these are approved each year within our system?
Ms. Smith.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, in years of budget crisis, so to speak, quite a few are used, generally, not a handful, I would say.
Are there further questions on Senate File 1236? Senator Betzel.
Sure. On the amendment that we've just adopted, AO7-0230, the last lines on 125, 126, it refers to the Minnesota State Retirement Association. And I think it's the Minnesota State Retirement System. In fact, I know it is. It's MSRS.
Mm-hmm. Well, since we're adding new language, we certainly could do that, even though in the current law, in the current statutes, apparently they still had the word association. Mr. Bodering, can we just make that change here?
Certainly.
Senator Betzel moves that we, on line 126 of the 0230 amendment, that we strike the word association and insert the word system. Any discussion? All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Is there any more discussion on Senate File 1236 as amended? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to comment on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Lurie moves that Senate File 1236 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Michelle. Senator Ortman, I don't. Oh, Senator Ortman just walked in. Senator Ortman, we are ready for your two bills. Senator Ortman has Senate File 547, Scott County Library Board.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 547 comes to us from Scott County, and you almost hate to say that it's a simple bill because that's usually the kiss of death around here, but I'm going to say I think it's pretty straightforward, let's say it that way. Scott County, like Carver County, has a library board, and the Scott County Library Board and the County Board have agreed to shift some of the duties from the Scott County Library Board, which oversees all of the libraries, to the County Board, in particular the administrative duties, the operations and the management, in particular the budget functions for the county library system. The library board, after if we pass this bill, will still be intact and will advise with the development of the budget, will advise with respect to hours of operations, with respect to the collection, with respect to policies within the library board. But this is an agreed-upon shift of power between the county board and the county library board, and so I'm hopeful that this committee will support what these two entities have elected to do on behalf of their service for the residents of Scott County. And I have with me today the chairman of the Scott County Board, John Ulrich, and also the chair of the library board is here as well to answer any questions that you may have, and they might like to present this bill a little bit further, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Commissioner Ulrich, if you'd like to make a few
Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity to say a few points regarding the bill. Senator Ortman has outlined quite a few of the aspects of it, but this is modeled after Washington County, who sought the same legislation to shift from the library board to the county board managing the library. It's patterned after what is done in Hennepin County and St. Paul and the city of Duluth. The library board would still retain review and purchase of materials, provide advice and direction, and make recommendations to the county board. Bringing the library board, the library into the, under the county board would provide a greater citizen accountability and greater integration to the larger county and a greater degree of library visibility. The library board, when they were considering this, weighed heavily on the experience of what they had in Washington County, and they observed the positive experiences there and are in favor of this change. Pat Conley, the Washington County Library Director, is here with us this afternoon, and she outlined a number of positive outcomes from this change. It was more efficient management and greater, more efficient, more quick response because the board, the county board, meets more frequently, and it was the library became more integrated into the county and the culture of the county and the life of the county. And then also the communication between the public and the library and those who were elected became closer. So we were seeking the same legislation in Scott County.
Ms. Conley, did you want to add anything?
My name is Kate Olson, and I'm president of the County Library Board, Madam Chair. And is all I would want to add is that the Scott County Library Board endorses this move from being an independent county library board to becoming an advisory library board to the county commissioners.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. I'm sorry I misidentified you.
Madam Chair, Actually, Pat Connolly's in the audience. I may have misled you there.
Are there questions for either the commissioner or the president of the library board? Seeing none, Senator Roebling?
Madam Chair, I'd like to move that Senate File 547 be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor.
We've heard the motion. Is there any discussion? Senator Roebling moves that Senate File 547 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you very much. Senator Ortman, we have another of your bills. Senate File 1045.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. I'm going to try and make this as exciting as I possibly can. Senate File 1045 is a name change from the Scott County Housing and Redevelopment Authority to the Scott County Community Development Agency. And this is, they are required by statute to seek a name change. Carver County did it last year. Scott County is here asking for permission to do the same thing. And I hope the members of this committee will support this bill. With me is Kathy Haney from Fagree and Benson, I'm sorry, and she's here on behalf of the current Housing and Redevelopment Authority to request this name change.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Marty, would you consider moving it to the consent calendar? Senator Marty moves that Senate File 1045 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion of that motion?
Madam Chair?
Senator Betzel.
Only that Mr. McGowan's summary is longer than the bill. So.
Right. Sorry.
This is an easy committee. I'd like to come back.
We have whose motion was it? Senator Marty's motion that Senate File 1045 be recommended to pass and be placed on the consent calendar. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Thank you,
Senator
Madam Chair,
Ortman.
Members.
Senator Higgins. Senator Coring, if after this bill we have your amendments, we'll go back to your bill and take it up. If you're ready, Mr. Bodern's not in the room right now. Senator Higgins brings us House File 960. Senator Higgins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 960. Senate File 960.
Yes.
Okay. Madam Chair, this is a simple bill that would allow local governments to decide for themselves who they would provide benefits to for their employees. Let me give you just a little bit of background. In 1995, the city of Minneapolis was sued by a taxpayer arguing that the city had exceeded its authority in providing health care benefits to its employees' unmarried partners. In this decision, the Court of Appeals noted that the legislature had enacted a specific statute authorizing local governments, including cities, counties, school districts, and the like, to provide benefits to employees, employees' spouses, and employees' dependent children, and including, in some circumstances, their adult children. The court held that in doing so, the state had intended to fully regulate the area of employee benefits provided by local governments, and that accordingly, they could offer only the benefits that were in the categories in statute. And because employees' unmarried domestic partners don't appear on this list, the court ruled that the local government had exceeded its authority. This bill would restore the principle of local control over local affairs by permitting the local government to provide benefits at their discretion to categories of people beyond employees, spouses, and children, the people who are now in statute. The legislation confers on local governments the ability to determine the health care benefits packages that work best for their employees. And we have a handout here. And before we go much farther, Mayor Coleman from St. Paul is here to speak on behalf of the bill, and I know he has a time crunch, so I'd like him to go first, please.
Mayor Coleman, if you identify yourself, please, for the record, we'll take your testimony now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Chris Coleman, Mayor of the City of St. Paul. I'm here today to speak on behalf of Senate File 960. I think it's a bill that appropriately restores to local units of government the ability to determine the terms and conditions of employment for their employees. In the city of St. Paul, we have approximately 2,700 employees. We extend health care benefits, among others, benefits to each and every one of our employees that we are allowed to under the law. But because of the court decision that was made in 1995, we have not been able to extend the exact same benefit to all categories of employees as we choose fit to do. We believe that this is an issue of local competitiveness. We believe that as we try to attract the best and the brightest employees to the city government, when we are competing against major corporations like 3M and Honeywell and Medtronic, General Mills, Excel, Ecolab, and other companies that do allow domestic partners to have employee benefits under their provisions of their employment, we believe that it's necessary for the city of St. Paul to be able to have that same ability to extend those benefits. There are certainly issues of human rights that surround this issue. There's nothing that I can say if you believe that to be the case that would make that any more so. If you don't believe that is the case, there's nothing that I can say to suggest we should extend employee benefits to domestic partners because of human rights concerns. But at the end of the day, we do believe that this is a decision that should be left up to the cities, the counties, and other local units of government that feel that this is important to be able to extend this right. I have no doubt that it affects our competitiveness, affects our ability to attract the best and the brightest employees. When you see that over 200 corporations in the state of Minnesota extend this benefit to their employees. So we ask that this very simple language in Senate File 960, which simply adds, and others as defined by governmental units at their discretion, we firmly believe that that language would be critical in the city of St. Paul and is appropriately vesting that ability to determine terms and conditions of employments in the areas where they belong, which is the cities or other local units of government.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Higgins, do you have other comments you'd like to make about the bill? Or
Madam Chair,
Hoover wants to testify.
Councilmember Scott Benson is here from the City of Minneapolis, somewhere back there. Okay.
Good afternoon, Chair Rask, Senators.
Councilmember Benson, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. I'm Councilmember Scott Benson from the 11th Ward in the City of Minneapolis. On behalf of Mayor Ryback and the City Council, I'm here to testify in favor of this bill. Last week, the City Council passed unanimously support for this bill in the City of Minneapolis. In 1993, when the city adopted its benefits program, we were at that time a leader in providing this form of benefit in order to be competitive in the marketplace. As Mayor Coleman indicated, in 1995, the city was enjoined from doing so. Since that time, as Mayor Coleman noted, 200 companies, and I attended a continuing legal education course today. Those of you who are lawyers know the joy and pain of that experience, but indicating that 72% of the law firms polled by the Minnesota State Bar Association also offer domestic partner benefits. It truly is an issue of competition for our cities. To be able to provide benefits to our city employees that are commensurate with those that are being provided in the private sector. I'm afraid that since 1995 and the injunction that was placed on the city, we have fallen behind. And we are not able to offer benefits packages that are attractive to our city employees, as attractive as are being offered in the private sector. And so again, as Mayor Coleman indicated, it is our hope in the city of Minneapolis that the legislature would allow cities to remain competitive and be able to offer these benefits to our employees.
Thank you very much, Councilmember Benson.
Madam Chair, Jan Fondell, who is a City of Minneapolis employee, is here to speak.
Ms. Fondell, if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Hi, my name is Jan Fondell. I live and work in the City of Minneapolis, and I really appreciate having the opportunity to talk to this committee about this. I'm not here in the context of my work. I'm here in the context of my life. My partner and I have been together for the last 15 years, both of us born and raised in Minnesota, just living our lives. I've worked in local government for the last 10 years. For most of the time, my partner and I were employed full-time and able to get benefits through our employer.
Two and a half years ago, my partner became unable to work in her profession as a psychologist due to a debilitating migraine disease. In addition to dealing with the emotional and financial impact of losing the ability to work, we were left with the added burden of paying 100% of her health care cost, even though I have an employer at this point that would really like to provide those benefits. For most of this time, I have worked for an employer that wanted to provide the benefits but wasn't able to because of state law. Throughout the entire period, though, I have paid for my health care premiums and the premiums of my children through my employer. So I do pay for family coverage through my employer, but I'm not able to include my domestic partner. During 2006, we paid nearly $8,000 in health care premiums, deductibles, and copays for my partner, and that was in addition to the costs that I currently pay to cover the rest of my family. Had she been able to be included in my coverage, our additional cost for premiums, deductibles, and copays would have been zero. Because of the prohibition of local government being able to make the decision about whether to include domestic partners in our health care plans, we paid $675 a month additional in health care premiums. This gave me serious pause about whether I was able to continue in public service. I am a good public servant, and I very much want to continue to work in local government. I loved working for the city that I live in. I feel passionately about public service, and this really put me to the wall about whether I could continue to do that or whether I needed to take my skills into the private marketplace. The ironic twist in all of this is that after 2 years on Social Security disability, my partner became eligible for Medicare and ineligible for continued COBRA. With no other opportunities for health insurance, she now receives health care benefits from the government. Over the years, this conversation about public employees and domestic partner benefits has happened in our state in various forms. Arguments have taken different forms, but ultimately it has boiled down to the notion that the public would be paying for a supporting relationship some people don't approve of. The irony of our situation is that the public is paying far more for the health care of my partner now than they would have if she simply would have been able to be on my health care benefits. It seems to me that regardless of relationship status, it is in the financial interest of the state to allow greater access to private health insurance rather than forcing people to go without health insurance or onto public programs. To continue to prohibit local governments from determining what benefits they would like to provide their employees is both unfair and, to me, it seems fiscally irresponsible. I would ask you to support local governments in determining whether or not they choose to provide these benefits to employees. Thank you.
Senator Higgins, do you have any other testimony?
Mr. Cooper, right here.
Mr. Cooper?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Scott Cooper. I'm here representing Outfront Minnesota. I would like to speak in favor of the bill and thank Senator Higgins for bringing this common sense step forward to all of you. You've heard a little bit about the history of this issue in Minnesota and how for a period of time the city of Minneapolis did offer these benefits and they were taken to court, and the court ruled that since you had not explicitly granted them the right to do that, they could no longer do it. Since then, we have a few times brought to you the concept of changing it, and it hasn't moved forward yet. We hope this year it will move forward to the floor and to the governor's desk and become law. As you know, since the time of that court decision, the state of Minnesota has also taken on this issue and did briefly offer domestic partner benefits to its employees under the Ventura administration. As I mentioned on a different bill last week for state employee domestic partner benefits, we believe that this is simply the fair thing to do to treat all of your employees equally regardless of their sexual orientation. We believe it's good business. It allows you to be competitive in attracting and retaining the best employees. We believe that this is something that is simple and straightforward to do. Many corporations do it, and many public units of government do it. Obviously, on this bill, we also have the issue of local control. This is a decision that should be made at the local level by those who are responsible for their employees, for establishing the benefits for those employees, those who hold election certificates as mayors and city council members and county commissioners. And we would hope that you would allow them to be able to make those decisions. I was happy to be able to come before you last week and talk about domestic partner benefits for your employees, state employees, and unfortunately I would not be able to go and have that conversation before a county board or a city council because they are prohibited from making that same decision that you all made last week. I would also like to point out that in our conversation about domestic partner benefits on a different bill last week, there was some testimony that these benefits should be extended to not only same-sex domestic partners, but also opposite-sex domestic partners. Perhaps the benefits should be extended to other close relatives for whom you are a caregiver. This subject was discussed and not incorporated into that bill. I would like to point out that this language doesn't prohibit that from happening. This language simply allows the local unit of government to define dependent for themselves. So if a city council or county board decided that they wanted to extend benefits not only to same-sex domestic partners but also opposite-sex domestic partners, or if they wanted to institute some sort of elder care program where their employees could include their elderly parents who were dependent on them for health care on their health plans, that would be a matter for them to decide, a matter for them to pay for if they could, and that's an issue that really should be left up to them. I would like to just point out some of the handouts that were passed out to you. One of them is a list of major employers that have employees in Minnesota who offer domestic partner benefits, along with a list of states and local units of government that do this across the country. It's a partial list. There's also an editorial before you, which I thought summed up the argument nicely, that appeared in the St. Paul Pioneer Press last Wednesday, I believe it was. And you also have some letters of support here. You have a letter addressed to the leadership of the legislature and the governor, which is signed by the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Rochester, Duluth, and St. Joseph, and some local elections officials from the city of Duluth and St. Louis County. There are other bodies currently considering resolutions. You also have a letter from the Minnesota Association of Small Cities, which represents 371 cities in Minnesota with populations of 5,000 or less. They discussed this issue and unanimously, I believe, passed a resolution in support of it. You also have in your packet a Hennepin County Board resolution, which passed recently in a bipartisan vote, five people voting for it, only one person voted against it. You have a resolution which was passed by the City of Minneapolis and a resolution passed by the City Council of St. Paul. This also has the support of labor unions. AFSCME supports this and has been lobbying on it. And the St. Paul Federation of Teachers recently passed it. I believe Education Minnesota statewide also has a position in favor of this legislation. I would ask for your support.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to speak in opposition to this bill? Are there any questions for the witnesses or for Senator Higgins? Seeing none, Senator Marty moves that Senate file 960 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you
very
much.
Thank you very
much. Are we ready with Senator Klein? We're not quite there with Senator Coring yet. We're going to take up, but we're going to skip and take Senator Wieger's bills. We need to get him in here because his bills need to go to finance. We'll just wait for him to come in. I think we are going to be able to get through the entire agenda. However, Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, are we going in order?
Senator Wieger.
Madam Chair, are we going in order, item 16?
We what?
Are we taking 1246 or 387?
We can take either one.
Okay. Madam Chair,
both
we'll go 1246. This is the Department of Education's omnibus policy bill. It's mostly technical, non-controversial items, and the provision I believe that you're interested in is for rulemaking for the graduation assessments, and there's some special cases that need to be addressed. And to comment further on what might be in the proposed rule, I have Dr. Mattson, Dirk Mattson from the Department of Ed, and others, depending on the committee's appetite.
Senator Wieger, would you point out the rulemaking provisions again? We don't have a summary here, so I need to have you say what you're going to do.
Madam Chair, I believe it's 6.28. Let me pull a bill here. Page 8, line 12 and 13 is the direction for the commissioner to establish rules.
Is that the only two lines?
Yes. Yes, Madam Chair.
In the whole bill?
Yes.
We're very good at catching things, aren't we?
Yes, you are.
Thanks for coming.
Senator Betzholm?
Madam Chair, hold it.
Did you find something else?
Page 18.
Page 18?
Line 16 to 18. Well, this is amending rules, apparently, for diversity.
That one's here, but I'm going to have to ask Chaz for that.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, we're going to have Chaz Anderson address that. Sure. I believe St. Paul schools may have added that as an amendment.
Madam Chair, Chaz Anderson, Deputy Education Minister.
Anderson.
Senator Betzold, that was amended into the bill in the previous committee. That's just providing a waiver requirement in the existing desegregation rules. It's not establishing any new rules, but providing a waiver for school districts. In St. Paul's case, they have to have multiracial balance, but the rule is talking about balance between white students and students of color, and that may not be feasible in an urban school district such as St. Paul. So this is just providing a waiver process for those situations. It still keeps intact parental choice, and if a parent wanted to move the student to another school, they could do this. So.
Anybody have any other questions? And, Senator Weger, you're assuring us that those are the only two places where rules are mentioned.
Yes. Madam Chair, that's my understanding, and the department which wrote the bill. Yes.
Okay, then, is there anyone who wants to testify other than the witnesses at the table on this bill? Seeing none, Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1246 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance.
Okay.
All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is sent to Finance. Senator Weger, Senate File 387.
Madam Chair, this initiative is from the Minnesota Board of School Administrators, and it just extends from 2007, June 30, to 2008, a one-year extension for rulemaking authority. Dr. Judith Lamp is here to address further the intent and why that would be needed for the one-year extension.
Why do you need another year? That's what we need to know.
We needed an additional year to address.
Excuse me, you need to identify yourself for the committee on the record.
I'm sorry. Madam Chairperson and committee members, we are requesting an additional amount of time.
I need you to state your name for the record.
Dr. Judith M. Eaton Lamp, L-A-M-P. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of School Administrators.
Thank you.
We are respectfully requesting the extension so that we can address more detail the safety concern that was brought up by the legislature and mandated for us to address for the competencies for preparing administrators, school administrators, and also to give us a greater opportunity to get more input from the teacher organizations, principals, superintendents, et cetera. We've already had them on our task force, but we want to get a broaden the input.
Okay. Are there questions for the witness? Senator Larson moves that Senate File 387 be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion?
Madam Chair, if it could be referred to Finance.
Senator Weger, we understand, doesn't need to be unless you want it to go there.
Madam Chair, the intent for the Finance and Policy Bill will be rolled together in an omnibus.
I see. Senator Larson amends his motion to recommend that Senate File 387 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Coring. We now have Senate File 1176 back in front of us, and Senator Coring has what amounts to an author's amendment. Senator Lurie moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. Senator Coring, with this amendment, you are telling us that you've now met the guidelines that are put forth by this Committee on Task Force and Advisory Boards. Is that correct?
Run that by me again. I didn't hear you, Madam Chair.
You have met the requirements.
Yeah, that's
of
right,
guidelines.
Madam Chair. Yep.
So your elected official is someone appointed by the governor.
Right.
You have a convener of the area manager of the Cuyuna County.
Yep.
You have duties in paragraph D.
And then.
And you have a reporting requirement.
Mm-hmm. In paragraph E.
And you have an expiration date.
A sunset date, yep.
Senator Betzel.
Well, Madam Chair, again, page one, line 19.
I'm sorry, Senator Betzel, I can't hear you.
Yeah. If you look at the bill that we're amending, it requires an elected state official. Now, adding appointed by the governor, I think, adds some problems because there aren't very many elected state officials other than judges on the appellate courts and the constitutional officers.
Senator Coring, who did you have in mind as a potential person that would fill that role?
Well, Madam Chair, I would just say I have no idea. This wasn't my idea. It's it's former Representative Chris Haskamp and a group of concerned citizens up here who came forward with this legislation, and I've been just trying to foster it through the process. So in all honesty, it makes no difference to me, but I think that's what their intent was. And so I think they...
You need that person at all.
Yeah. I, Madam Chair, I think they wanted to have kind of a liaison to the state somehow. So... And Madam Chair,
you
could...
You mean perhaps you want a legislator?
Yeah, Madam Chair, would it...
Actually, you don't want a legislator because that would send this bill to rules.
Okay.
How can we help him out here? We could just delete it.
Strike number five in the meeting.
We could just delete it.
Madam Chair, let's just delete that out of there. And
they're going to be responsible.
Right.
So on line two, we're just going to delete, on line two of the amendment, we'll just delete page one, line 19.
Mm-hmm.
And then an instruction to renumber the clauses.
Big part. And with the instruction to renumber the clauses.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yes. So we are actually, we adopted this amendment, so now we have to go back and take that part out. But we understand what we're doing here, correct? We're amending the... A1 amendment by striking line 1-2 of the amendment and instead striking line 19 on page 1 of the bill. Correct?
Madam Chair, that's right. You're amending page 1, line 2 of the amendment by, delete line 2 of the amendment and insert page 1, delete line 19.
Yes, okay. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 1176 before us as amended. Let's go. Let's go into finance. Senator Larson moves that Senate File 1176 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion? please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion fails. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you.
Reporting. Okay.
Now take up Senate File 981. Welcome back to the committee in this capacity again, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, and I do have an amendment.
Amendment is being passed around. This would be an author's amendment. Senator Rust moves this author's amendment. All in favor? Aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The author's amendment, just to bring you up to date on that, does include a bill that is actually gone out of this committee before Senate File 19, which repealed the Legislative Commission on Metropolitan Governments. It's already passed the Senate, but we're trying to encourage the House to take up the issue. And so I'm putting it on this, on the comprehensive plan bill from the Met Council, and then some additional language in lines 13 through 16, which allows more discretion with regard to the review and comment period, takes away one additional bureaucratic step there. What the bill does now, just to the substance of it, is to first of all, indicate that the 60-day rule or 60-day period in Section 1 for the requirement to have a review within 60 days does not apply to the comp plan. So that's what 473-175 is if you see that in other references in the bill, and you'll see that coming up again. The second section is merely updating a reference. In subdivision 2 of Section 2, it eliminates the option to request a hearing prior to Met Council's response on people or cities, local governments submitting their comp plan. Subdivision 3 in there is also the extra language is once again updating references. So is Section 3. And Section 4 and Section 5. In Section 6, the new language there is an attempt to clarify the notion that Met Council has to prepare and transmit system statements when it updates development guides or actually changes anything else. So it's a clarification of what their obligation is to the local governments. And secondly, beginning now at line 429, it clarifies that cities have 3 years to determine, after receiving those, whether an amendment to their comp plan is going to be necessary. In Section 7, it corrects references and, again, allows an exception by mutual consent to the 60-day period for a hearing. And we, in Section 8, it clarifies some timelines for amending the comp plans. And in subdivision 2, it makes a requirement of the local governments that they need to notify special districts within their area if they are making when they're making proposed plans to the Met Council. And let's see, section 9 is a technical correction, and that's where we also, page 6, by the way, line 17, which is in subdivision 2, is where we inserted that language of waiving the review and comment period if the lands that are involved are not contiguous to other local government units, rather than just talking about the not less than 60 days language. Then section 10 extends that 60-day time period by mutual consent. If they want more, if both parties want more time, they get it. Section 11 is also elimination of a reference to ordinances. Section 12 makes the Planning Assistance Fund discretionary with the Met Council rather than obligatory. Section 13 is the same as 9 and 11, which is reference to the ordinance. So too is Section 14. Section 15 is a repealer, and we also added an additional repealer, 473-247. We added that in the amendment, and 473-247 is a requirement to publish a consolidated bulletin amendment, which Mr. Scheckman just handed me. There are six metropolitan agencies: Parks and Open Space, Regional Transit Board, the Transit Commission, Waste Control, the Airports Commission, and the Sports Facilities Commission, some of which no longer exist. And some of those functions were transferred to the council. So we're just eliminating that requirement. So, Mr. Chairman and members, that's the bill. Most of it is technical. It's adding a little bit of flexibility to the relationship between local governments and the Met Council with regard to the decennial comprehensive plans that the local governments need to be working on. This is the third time that they're going through this planning cycle for their comp plans, and there are no particular major policy changes within this bill. Mr. Scheckman is here to answer questions. If anybody has questions,
anybody have any questions?
And I point out that the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, do they have a new name?
Metro Cities.
Metro Cities, now known as Metro Cities, is in support of the changes.
Okay. Seeing no questions from the members, anybody from the audience care to speak to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Rest moves.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 981 as amended be recommended to pass.
Senator Rest moves that Senate File 981 be recommended to pass. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. Motion carries.
What's next?
Thank you, Senator Rest, and we will move on to Senate File 1017.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 17 was or is a proposal to allow for an increase in the expenditures of city charter commissions in order to inform the constituents in a given city of changes that may be proposed to a charter. The limit of $1,500 for their expenses was set in 1961 and has not been changed since. If you apply a CPI to that $1,500 in 2006 dollars, it would amount to some $10,000. The bill only asks for an increase in their expenses to $5,000, and in a city of, for example, 10,000 people to mail out a letter with proposed changes on the commission, that one mailing would cost over $4,000, and I'm sure that all of us that do a lot of bulk mailing can appreciate that $1,500 would not allow charter commissions for cities to really fulfill their obligations. Now, it's perhaps relatively rare for a charter commission to get to the point of mailing out something to the voters, but it does at least give them the opportunity under raising this expenditure limit that hasn't been raised since for 46 years. So I hope you would support the bill.
Senator Rust, is there any are first class cities with the limit of 10,000 not? Has that been in effect since 1961 as well?
I think that this is a general law increase. I mean, I suppose that I suppose we could increase it for first-class cities, but the folks that were concerned about it were people from cities that are smaller. So that's where my focus is.
That's fine. I was just a general question. Any other questions from members? Seeing none, anyone from the audience care to speak to this bill? Seeing none, Senator Rust.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate file 1017 be recommended to pass.
Senator Rust moves Senate file 1017 be recommended to pass. Any discussion? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. One more bill before us today.
One more.
And 4 minutes to go. Wow.
Or maybe 5 minutes.
Senate file 1377.
Mr. Chairman, during the interim, Representative Tingelstad had been really working when she was chair of the State Government Operations Committee in the House on addressing the issue of boards and advisory groups which had been sunsetted in previous legislation into 2003, nevertheless were still on the books. And so basic premise of Senate File 1377 is to make the statute books shorter by getting rid of a lot of language that is no longer necessary because these boards are actually not in existence. Her process was to send letters out to the various commissioners of our state agencies and asking them to review any task forces or advisory boards in their state agency to see whether there was a reason for them to continue. There are some that are continued. Mr. Bodern had indicated that earlier. some that are continued because they have a federal component or whatever, and there are some that are also just named in the statute. We've tried to be very careful about the ones that are eliminated. We have heard in the last couple of days of ones that are eliminated where they have indicated that there indeed is a function to their existence, and they've asked to be put back or are not eliminated in the statutes. In addition, I had a request from the Department of Administration to keep the issues of who will provide staffing and support for advisory boards out of this bill for right now, because right in the Commissioner of Administration, that department is asking for the setup of a small department within their agency to render this kind of assistance, but it needs an appropriation. So what I agreed to do was to take those sections out of the bill and just do the repealers, absent the ones that we're going to keep in law, and we can perhaps take up that part of the policy change in a subsequent session. So I have an amendment.
A1 or A2 or?
That will delete, first of all, I'm going to have a couple of amendments here. First of all, is anybody here yet from the department? Hi, yeah. First of all, at the commissioner's request to delete section 1 and section 3. So, Mr. Chairman, as an author's amendment, I move that we delete sections 1 and 3.
In Article 1?
Of Article 1?
Beg your pardon?
Article 1.
Article 1, yes.
No, because we want to keep the
What page?
Article 1, sections 1 and 3. Okay. We want to keep a requirement of the notice from the Secretary of State's office to the appointing authority in the bill. But the requirements being placed on the Commissioner of Finance and the Commissioner of Administration, we're trying to remove at her request.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we just want to make sure you were talking about Article 1 because you said Section 1, Section 3, and we had to make sure we were in the right article to do
that. Yes, I'm sorry. Okay. Yeah, Article 1.
Thank you, Senator
Butzel. That's the article that puts additional.
Right.
Senator.
That's the article that would have a fiscal note, and by taking out Sections 1 and 3, I think we get rid of the fiscal note.
Okay, Senator Rest moves the author's amendment to strike Sections 1 and Section 3 from Article 1. Everybody understand this? All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chairman, I have the A3 amendment.
Oh, we don't have that. We have A1 and A2.
Mr. Chairman? Senator Rest, that was provided to me by Representative Tingelstad, and it's actually no longer necessary given that you've deleted Section 1.
Okay. So then I have the A2 amendment, Mr. Potter.
It's in the packet.
A2 we have amendment. That in the packet.
It's an author's amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And that reinstates, I'm going to have to ask Mr. Bodden while I'm quickly looking for it, that reinstates the authority for which of the advisory boards?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, that reinstates the authority for the Ombudsman Committee for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities.
Okay, that's the only group that is addressed by the A2 amendment?
That's correct.
Okay, and they had emailed me and said that that's a very vital part of their function and they actually needed to have that. And then the A1 amendment... Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor? Aye.
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 Opposed? The Motion carries.
And Mr. Bodern, that, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bodern, that references what?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, that's the Minnesota-Ontario Boundary Commission, Legislative Commission.
To delete it?
Yes.
And we also had a request from the Arts Board to delete, which would mean that we stay in law, page 6, section 6, the advisory committee there that would, we would just delete that section, which means that they would stay in existence, and then we would not be repealing anything there.
Senator Rest moves.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest.
Yes.
It actually occurs to me perhaps the better thing to do would be to reinstate the stricken language and then insert a clause that says notwithstanding section 15.059, or you could insert a particular expiration date, or we could return to it at a later date, your preference. But it is the by simply deleting it, the ambiguity will remain as to whether they expire.
Mr. Bodern, could we have an amendment then that extended it out 4 years with that right. language, to reinstate the stricken language and to insert that the notwithstanding other authority, that its life is extended until June 30th of 2011?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Rest, I note it's an authority to appoint various advisory committees, and I think what's unclear there is how long those particular advisory committees exist, and perhaps after committees on page 6, line 24, you could insert for a term of no longer than 4 years as a placeholder right now.
Okay.
And then the other part of the amendment would be on page 6, lines 24 to 27 to 24 to 28, reinstate the stricken language.
That would be my amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Bodern, could you repeat the first part again, the four-year limit?
Certainly. I'll restate the entire amendment, Mr. Chairman. On page 6, lines 24 to 28, reinstate the stricken language. And on page 6, line 24, after committees, insert for a term of no more than 4 years.
Okay. Senator Rest moves this author's amendment. Does everybody understand it? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I would direct members' attentions to sections 10 and 11. We got a request from the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association to reinstate sections 10 and 11, which is the committee that advises the Commissioner of Public Safety on awarding grants, that is an operative committee as well.
So by that, so suggesting that we strike sections 10?
So I think that one 10. Is just a plain deletion of sections 11. 10 and 11.
On pages 7 and 8. Senator Rest moves striking sections 10 and 11 on pages 7 and 8. Everybody understand? All in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, that is the extent of the amendments to this bill.
We have it in shape?
I think so.
Okay.
So, Mr. Chairman, I don't have any particular testifiers.
Okay.
So I would move that Senate File 1377 as amended be recommended to pass.
And sent to judiciary.
And sent to judiciary.
Okay. Any discussion? Anybody from the audience care to speak to this bill? Seeing none. All in favor of Senator Rust's motion to recommend Senate File 1377 pass and be referred to judiciary, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion carries.
And, Mr. Chairman, There was some confusion today in the introduction of Senate File 1753, which is an airport funding advisory task force, as to which committee it was actually sent to. And I wonder if Ms.
Packets.
If Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen has that.
It's in finance.
It is in finance. Okay. So we'll take it up in the transportation committee first, but I hope that they will allow it to come back to here rather than being included in the omnibus bill so that we can deal with the task, because it really is a task force, even though the subject matter deals with the airports. Well, there was some confusion earlier today.
Well,
Senator Betzold.
Mr. Chair, perhaps, and it should be moved from the Finance Committee to the Transportation Policy Committee.
That's a good point. Let's move it.
Are we?
Well,
we're not hearing this bill and moving it here today.
It does have an appropriation.
No, but if it's in the Finance Committee, only Senator Cohen's committee can move it out. If
True.
It's in the transportation is both policy and budget. If you send it
yes.
to the Policy Committee,
right.
Senator Murphy's policy side can hear the bill and they can report it out.
Right.
And they're meeting more regularly than the Finance Committee.
Yes.
So it would be probably
Thank
better
you.
To move
I,
it over
yes.
to the Transportation Policy Committee.
Except that it went to finance.
But a motion on the floor could get it
to the Transportation Committee.
Right.
If the committee administrator will note that, we'll try and take care of that on Wednesday.
Yeah.
There's no further business for the committee.
Having no further business, the committee is adjourned. Thank you.
Okay.